Welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002, Houston's community station, 90.1 FM and HD1. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. In this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1044, I will have three segments. First, I will air the remaining questions and answers that followed the panel discussion I aired last week titled Women in Coalitions, Challenges and Successes. That panel was part of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee's 2022 Alex Saudi Memorial Conference and Gala held in October 2022 in California, where they explored the issues that impact the community while honoring Alex Saudi and celebrating Arab American excellence and achievement. Some of the questions addressed at that panel, Women in Coalitions, Challenges and Successes, that I plan to air today, were about voting, empowering communities, engaging elected officials, political education, elevating young women leaders, advice to young women starting in the political world, and the rise in anti-Muslim hate in India. During the second segment, I will air a talk about Hindutva, an ideology that advocates for Hindu supremacy. That talk was delivered at the ICNAMAS convention held in Baltimore, Maryland in May 2022 by Ajit Sahi, Advocacy Director at the Indian American Muslim Council. During the third segment of today's episode, I will share information about a new and first-of-its-kind report released by the Council on American Islamic Relations and JETPAC that documents 189 elected officials who identify as Muslim across 30 states in the United States of America. It is the first national directory of local, state, and federal elected Muslim officials and judges. The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC, the largest Arab American grassroots civil rights organization in the United States, committed to defending the rights of people of Arab descent and promoting their rich cultural heritage, held its 2022 Alex Saudi Memorial Conference and Gala on October 7th and 8th, 2022 in California, where they explored the issues that impact the community while honoring Alex Saudi and celebrating Arab American excellence and achievement. During the last episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1043, I aired the remarks delivered at that panel titled Women in Coalitions, Challenges and Successes, moderated by Cheryl Farris. The panel explored how organizational and individual bonds overlap to affect and influence redistricting designations for voting rights, monitoring the police, and pressuring elected officials toward legislation that ensures effective changes for justice. The speakers on that panel were Boki Dominguez, co-founder of San Diego's Racial Justice Coalition, Janine Ariqat, Palestinian Muslim American serving as the policy lead at the Partnership for the Advancement of New Americans, and Tazheen Nizam, Executive Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE San Diego. I also aired some of the questions and answers that followed the panel discussion, and now I am going to air the remaining questions and answers. Let's listen in, and the voice you will hear first is that of Tazheen Nizam.
Coupled with what Majid had asked earlier about our 80-20 effort and what that is asking, the political power building of our community is so important because this is a pivotal time in our history. We need to capitalize on that. So, you know, voter engagement, voter education, and understanding the importance of voting. Because I still go to mosque and people tell me, why are you asking me to register to vote? Voting is haram. And I was like, I'm not an Arabic speaker, but I'm sure that's not the word for it. So that mentality, breaking down those dumbfounded expressions of against voting or against voter engagement, or I really have a difficult time when I register somebody to vote, is like, why do you want me to register to vote? They're all the same. Use your brain, people. They are, on the surface, they may seem the same. I'm not going to deny that. I work for a nonpartisan organization. I have to say that. But use your personal judgment to determine whose policies are going to be beneficial for your community. So yes, within our communities, within our house, we do need to subject a lot of time, effort, energy, money into education and power building within our communities. Because if we are not having that strong base, we will not be able to show up in collective, large numbers as a collective community to our outside world. So the 80-20 effort, yes, Majid, you are absolutely right. Within our communities, get strengthened, get power building, but also continue to show up on the outside. So with that, political education, I know that you have such an eminent passion for the political advocacy and the political education. So I want to tell this to, like, I know we talk about, like, you know, partisan politics and things. It's not about partisan politics. It's about empowering your community to understand that they have a voice. It's empowering your community to carry that vote, that level of engagement with their elected official. And ADC has been doing an amazing job at it. You know, we always have those meetings before elections with our candidates. So this is one thing that I learned. When I worked initially in political engagement, it was about hosting your elected officials accountable all the time. But with due course of time, I realized that if we don't get the right people in and ask the right questions before elections, we're going to end up with the wrong people. So hosting your candidates is also just as important as your elected officials, asking them the right questions and reminding them that we're here on this end of the election cycle. When you get elected, we'll show up on the other side and ask for your accountability as well.
If I could just add to Aoun, because that's exactly what I was thinking of that you both said, is in addition to like the internal political education for our community, I think as a community, we need to start thinking through what are our policy demands, like Tazian outlined, right? People are in office because of us. I think sometimes our community forgets sight of that. We don't see it in the day-to-day sometimes. But the reality is we have concerns in our community. We have things we want to change and better for ourselves. And we need to have policy demands and start presenting them. It doesn't mean we'll get an answer in the next 6 months or the next year, et cetera. It could be a long fight. But there's power in us consistently showing up, like Tazine, like Bookie said, in front of electeds and reminding them that we're here, especially as the Arab community, because we're not showing up on the scorecards. There's no way for them to see how Arab voters vote, right? Because we're not in the census. And that's why it's so important for us to show up and remind them that we do have power in their seats and getting them elected, and we have demands that we want to be met.
Thank you all for being here. I know all of you, I've known all of you for some time, and you are very much role models, personally, professionally, for me, and I find all of you as true inspirations, and very much look up to you. What was the greatest piece of advice that was given to you by a fellow woman, whether it was something personal, professional, just something that you use in your daily life?
First of all, before we start answering that, may I please have a round of applause for our San Diego president of our ADC chapter, yeah, please. Thank you. With that, this is not advice, but that I received with time, and I wish I had, but definitely elevating our young women leaders. That's advice I would give somebody forward. Because guess what? When you pave the path for someone else, your path gets easier. So I wasn't given this advice, but I'd like to give it forward. But recently I was going through some video and something, and one thing that stuck with me is realize that people are not going to show up like you do. People are not going to show up with your same mindset because they don't have the heart that you do. They don't have at stake what you do. So give people space and grace and you do your thing.
I don't think I ever received any advice.
What advice would you give to a young woman just starting out in a political world?
It's a very hard question to answer. What advice would I give? I would say look, observe, and most of all, listen. Things are never really what they seem. And I know that's very vague, but if you always remember that, it will take you places. And actually, I don't think I'm embellishing when I say it would actually save your life. So always have some little bit of reserve.
I'm like, these are really good nuggets I'm storing. I was told, because like as we discussed all the barriers that come up, specifically in coalitions, it was find your people. Find the people that you know are going to go to bat for you and who you're going to be able to support and find alignment with. Because we can't do it alone.
I don't recall getting a lot of good advice when I was young. I was kind of told to, shut up and sit still and try to look pretty and whatever. But I think the advice I would give to a young person now is you can do it all, especially to young women. And I did have the great opportunity of teaching young women in high school. And I love to tell them that you can do it. You're smart and you're powerful and don't let anyone put you down. And to that, for us, I would add, appreciate who you are. Live every minute of your heritage because it's so powerful and so wonderful. We just have about 5 more minutes. Any more questions? Yes.
I have a question. Actually, I have 2 questions, one for Tazeen and one for Buki. I'm a Twitter junkie, and I saw a study the other day. Somebody made a study. The biggest amount of anti-Muslim hate is coming out of India, which was surprising. And you have Indian experience. I also notice whenever Zionist tweet defending whatever Israel does, tons of Indians support the Israelis and say India stand with Israel. My question is, can you tell me why? And I know for a fact hardly any Indians work in Israel, why there is millions work in Arab countries. My question for Buki, was your father right about Europe? What is your experience? Compare Europe to the United States. Thank you.
Okay, her answer's long. I'll go ahead. yes and no. I've learned to say yes and no a lot, and it starts to annoy people because things are never really what they seem. I have learned the hard way. Yes, he was right about Europe because all the years I spent in Europe, credit was given to me where credit was due, and that was that. Every day was not a new day for me to prove myself, to explain myself, and to defend myself in the same spaces. Here in the U.S., every day is a new day. It almost feels like when somebody has Alzheimer's disease, where they're forgetful, the short-term memory is no more. So every day with that person is a new day. I feel in this society that I, speaking from my personal experience, every day is a new day. I have to defend myself every day. I have to defend my credentials every day. I have to prove to people every day that I have what it takes. And honestly, it's very exhausting. So Dad was right. On the employment level, too, he was right about Europe. I didn't have to hustle to get this dream union job. You could be unionized. You could have good health care, decent quality of life. So he was right there, too. But where he wasn't right about the U.S. was this is the land of endless possibilities. But unfortunately for a certain class and a certain group of people, and only a few people that look like myself get to make it into those spaces. So on that aspect too, compared to Europe, the opportunities might be more here in the U.S. than in Europe. But then again, it depends. Because I had much more career success in Europe as an immigrant woman than I think I do here.
So it may seem that the anti-Muslim sentiment in India is new, or for that matter, this annihilation of the Muslim populations in India is new. But this is not a today concept. In the early 40s, a woman named Savitri Devi wrote a book about ethnic cleansing and about making a nation an Aryan nation. And Hitler used references from that book. So that's how far it goes about the ethno-cleansing of Muslims from India. Growing up in the 80s, I remember, like, you know, the Congress party was in power, and they were very Muslim-friendly. Their policies were leaning towards Muslim. Then slowly you saw an upsurge of the BJP, the Shiv Sena, and these small, very Hindu-majority groups coming up. And it was a power-building move where they started building power in predominantly Hindu states like Uttar Pradesh and Madhya Pradesh, where and even now when I go back, there's Hindu holidays that are off for a whole week where we didn't even hear about them when we were little. So it has been a power-building move that they have done, and eventually the BJP came into power, and then they played their hand. The demolition of the Barbree Masjid in, I believe it was in 1990, that was first move to show that we can annihilate the Muslim history from India. We have a joke in our community. One day they're going to claim to say that Taj Mahal was not built by the Mughals, but by a Hindu king. It is a possibility because they have taken over a lot of monumental history of the Mughals. There are, you know, that there is a lot of violence against people who are thought to just be eating beef. They will pull over a man just to say, you're going to go buy beef and beat him to pulp. That happens in a lot of cities. The sale of beef is banned in a lot of states. So slowly, and I, you know, a way to a man's heart is through his stomach. When you take his meat away, what's he left with? Just kidding. That is a way of annihilating the population. The mosque, the schools, the mullahs, they are constantly on attack. And it is not just something that happened today. The BJP has been working on it for decades. And now they have come into power where they're doing that. I remember in the 90s, my cousins would say, oh, I'm going back to school to get another master's. And I'm like, why don't you just find a job? There are no jobs for Muslim women back in Uttar Pradesh. These women have 2 to 3 masters and they're sitting at home because they could not get jobs. The majority cities, like the metropolitan cities like Bombay and Madras and Hyderabad, have been a little better, but those policies are catching up with them also. In the state of Andhra Pradesh, the Telangana state, which is a majority ruling party of South India, has started to separate themselves from Hyderabad. Hyderabad was established by the Nizam of Hyderabad, who was a Muslim Mughal back from, I think it was from like 1600s when he had come. And they're separating those state lines. In the city of Mumbai, Bombay, where I was born, the names have changed from colonial names, which is not such a bad thing, but it is a power move, slowly, dynamically changing that. The education dynamics. I mean, we work in the United States, we work towards ethnic studies through bringing our identities. In India, it's a reverse movement of erasing the Mughal history, erasing the Muslim heritage and the history. So that move of power that we saw in Kashmir was just a reflection of what is going to happen in the rest of India. There, in Kashmir, before this, if you were not a Kashmiri resident, you were not allowed to buy property. And the Adjustment Citizenship Act took away those privileges. Now anybody can go and buy property in Kashmir. Those same policies exist in a city like Assam, where it's a Hindu population, but those, that ACC was not reflected in Assam, but it was in Kashmir because they want to annihilate the Muslim population of India systemically. And this is state-sanctioned systemic annihilation of Muslims throughout India, as we see the state-sanctioned annihilation of Palestinians in Palestine.
Wow, thank you. Thank you for that. Good question. Wonderful answer.
Can we take one last question?
It's not really a question, it's just also a wrap-up, and not to take that away from you, but this is a women's panel, so of course there are men involved in all these circumstances, but I have to say, having been intimately working with all of you, that it is 90% run by women in San Diego County, and so it's, I mean, I just had to say that to contextualize it a little bit. The meetings you have organized, the people who show up, we have had incredible turnout, even with some of the failures. The reason is the city council in El Cajon is racist and white, and they have to be called on that the next time. The reasons are Buki got off of CLRB because she said, why doesn't everybody get screened for drugs, including the employees when they go into the sheriff's office? Good question. That's when she got off CLRB. That's when she got pushed off CLRB. Somebody's hiding something. So it's not because of the lack of work you did. It's not because you didn't work with other women, indigenous, Mexican, other Latins. It's there's just next time we can clobber them with that. And in a way, these failures are empowering.
Well, and thank you, Doris, for all your work for ADC and for inviting me and inviting my other panelists here. It's been a wonderful experience. So thank you all.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Thank you, Cheryl.
What you just heard were questions and answers from the panel discussion titled Women in Coalitions, Challenges and Successes. It was one of several panels organized by the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee at its 2022 Alex Saudi Memorial Conference and Gala, held in October 2022 in California. During the last episode of Arab Voices, I aired the remarks delivered at that panel discussion, and that is archived on our website, arabvoices.net. For more information about the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, visit the organization's website, adc.org. You're listening to Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. One of the questions and answers you just heard from that panel was on the rise of anti-Muslim hate in India. Nearly 200 million Muslims in India are facing persecution, illegal arrests, and unlawful demolition of Muslim houses. Many are calling what is happening in India a genocide against Muslims. I'm going to air now a speech about Hindutva, an ideology that advocates for Hindu supremacy. That talk was delivered at the ICNA Mass Convention held in Baltimore, Maryland in May 2022 by Ajit Sahi, Advocacy Director at the Indian American Muslim Council. Let's listen in.
I'm here to talk to you about an ideology that I'm sure some of you know about. It is called Hindutva. That's a strange word. Hindutva is a word that basically denotes Hindu nationalism. Now, those of you who do not know, who have not heard of Hindu nationalism, must be wondering what is this about. But I would imagine that most of you are very, very aware of two other ideologies. One is Zionism, that needs no introduction. And the other is white racism, that also needs no introduction. Both these ideologies of Zionism and white racism are fundamentally anti-democratic ideologies that are supremacist to the core, because they believe in the supremacy of one set of people in exclusion of all the other people. We've seen what Zionism has done to the Middle East, especially in the last 75 years. The history of white racism, especially in the United States, has been extremely toxic. And now we have the ideology of Hindu nationalism. Just to give you a sense of what Hindu nationalism is, today is 28th of May. On this day, 28th of May, in 1883, a man was born in India. His name was Savarkar. That was his last name, Savarkar. He was a Brahmin, a Hindu Brahmin. In the year 1922, he first propounded this ideology of Hindutva. It is interesting how through the history of India, for hundreds of years, Indian Hindus and Christians and Muslims and Sikhs and Parsis and people of other faiths had lived together in peace and harmony. But around the end of the 19th century and the start of the 20th century, especially the British colonial masters, they started creating a divide between Hindus and Muslims. And that is when Savarkar created this ideology of Hindutva. This ideology is very clear. It says that India is the land of the Hindus because their forefathers started out in this country and they created the religion of Hinduism thousands of years ago. And the ideology of Hindutva also says that Muslims and Christians are foreigners, regardless of the fact that Christianity had existed on the Indian subcontinent for 2,000 years, regardless of the fact that Islam has existed on the Indian subcontinent from the time of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. This ideology said that Muslims of the subcontinent and Christians of the subcontinent were foreigners in their own country, where they had lived for centuries, for generations, because their religion, the ideology said, Savarkar said, had come from outside of India. This ideology started taking root around that time. And in 1925, just 2 or 3 years after Savarkar first propounded this ideology, a new organization was founded. The name of that organization is RSS, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh. Fast forward 100 years. Today, India is ruled by a political party which is an offshoot of the RSS. It is a Hindu nationalist party. Today, India's president, India's prime minister, India's vice president, India's cabinet of ministers, they're all people who belong to the RSS. They are sworn to the Hindutva ideology of Hindu nationalism. Their one goal, single goal, is to convert India into a Hindu country. India was freed from British colonial rule in 1947, and in 1950, fully 72 years ago, India gave itself a pluralist constitution that says all Indians are equal. Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Sikhs, Parsis, Jains, as well as people of no faith, they are all equal. This country belongs to all of them. But today, the RSS wants to change that constitution. They have already started with the citizenship law. Some of you may already know that in the last 8 years that the RSS has been in government in India, the attacks on Muslims have increased many, many fold. tens of thousands of people have been put in prison. Thousands of Muslims have been lynched merely for being Muslim, walking down the street with their, just because they're wearing a skull cap or they have a beard, they have been attacked in full public view and murdered. Tens of thousands of Muslim girls are being denied education in India because they wear the hijab. Mosques are attacked, vandalized, set on fire, demolished by the government. Muslim businesses, Muslim homes, they're all under attack. Now, the citizenship of India's 200 million plus Muslims is also under attack. This is an existential threat. This is, as has been said by a very, very reputed organization in the United States, Genocide Watch, this is a genocide of Muslims underway. Now pause for a minute and think about it. India has more than 200 million Muslims. By some estimates, the number is about 250 million. If India's Muslims were to be counted as a country, they would be the world's fifth most populated country. It is such a large body of people. And now we see there's intense hatred created by this ideology in India's society, in India's government, in India's legislatures, federal as well as state legislatures, where conversion is being criminalized, where Muslim men marrying non-Muslim women are being caught by the police and being sent to prison, where there is a fundamental attack to the very existence of Muslims because they are Muslims. Now you might ask, there is so many problems in the world. If there are so many countries where Muslims live and there are so many problems that Muslims in other countries face, why should we be focusing on India? There are two reasons why India has to be the number one priority, especially for American Muslims, especially for the global Muslim community also. The first reason is that this ideology of Hindutva is not anymore confined to India. It has now traveled across the globe. In Australia, in the United Kingdom, in the Baltic countries, in Germany, in Canada, and of course, right here in the United States of America, Hindutva ideology, the ideology of Hindu supremacy, is all around us. There are over a dozen organizations that are very closely connected with the RSS in India. These are organizations such as the Hindu Swayam Sevak Sangh, HSS, which is a mirror image of the RSS. There is a Vishv Hindu Parishad in India, there is a Vishv Hindu Parishad in America. There is a Hindu American Foundation which does political advocacy here, and it does not tolerate any criticism. Just about a few months ago, in July last year, they filed, the Hindu American Foundation filed a defamation suit against five people for calling out its closeness, ideological affinity with the Hindu supremacists. One of the people who have been accused of defamation and is being sued by Hindu American Foundation is sitting right here. He is my colleague and the executive director of Indian American Muslim Council, Rashid Ahmed. And there is intense pressure that is being brought by these Hindutva organizations on members of Congress, on city councils, on US senators, US government. Right now, these organizations are going around the United States with a traveling exhibition and trying to fool the people of this country, elected officials at the county levels, at city levels, at state levels, at federal levels, that, oh, we are good organizations, we support pluralism, we support multiculturalism, we support the fundamental ideals of the United States of America. But in truth, what they are doing is they are building up support in the United States for Hindu supremacy in India. They're building up support in the United States for Islamophobia in India, for Islamophobic policies of the government of India and the government of various provinces and states in India. They are the epitome of visceral, vile, evil hatred towards Muslims. They are influencing government decisions. Most of you must have heard that that Congresswoman Ilhan Omar brought the bill on Islamophobia that passed the House, that is now in the Senate. The biggest opposition to that bill in the Senate is coming from the Hindu organizations, or rather I should say the Hindu nationalist organizations in the United States of America. They have been sending emails, they have been making phone calls, they have been pressuring senators not to take up this bill. When the United Nations decided to recognize Islamophobia, the Indian ambassador to the United Nations, he was the only one who stood up and said, "We oppose this decision." Recently, in the last couple of years, just one example, it comes from the city of Naperville, which is close to Chicago in Illinois, where the local Muslim community was trying to expand the Islamic center. And when they submitted their application to the town planning board, suddenly the town planning board was besieged by tens of thousands of opposition emails, phone calls, and they were stunned because they had never, it's a sleepy town, they had never seen so much of opposition for a routine application to build a place of worship. And when they started investigating, what did they find? They found many of those emails, many of those phone numbers were not only not from Naperville, not only not from the Chicago area, not only not from Illinois, but actually many of them had originated from out of the United States of America. In history textbooks in the state of California, the Hindutva organizations for years have waged a war in an effort to force the California State Education Board to designate Islam as not a good religion, and Muslim rulers of India in the past centuries as invaders, as cruel rulers who committed a genocide of Hindus. None of this, of course, is rooted in history. None of this is a historical fact. But they do not care about facts. They are consumed. It's like white racists. It's like what we saw in the city of Buffalo merely 10 days ago, that this false narrative of replacement of the white people triggered a man who was 18 years old to go and kill 10 people. 10 unarmed, civilian, innocent people. That is the ideology that has taken root at a massive level. This was the first reason I gave you. The second big reason is, as I said earlier, one of the largest populations of Muslims globally lives in India. India has been a beacon of democracy in the last 75 years. After the Second World War, a number of countries around the world raced to freedom from colonial ownership, colonial rule. And it is remarkable how a poor country such as India, which literally was so impoverished, it did not even have, for generations there had been no education. People were poor, they lived in the villages, they were illiterate, and yet India was one country that chose democracy over authoritarianism after freeing itself in 1947. No other country in Asia, Southeast Asia, Africa, Latin America, even East Europe comes close to the absolutely amazing example of India in the last 75 years. And India has showed the way. Do not forget that Martin Luther King Jr. said, that I read Marx, I read Engels, I read all kinds of great leaders in history, but it is only when I read Mahatma Gandhi that I realized that the way forward for the African-American people, the way forward for America's civil rights movement is through what Gandhi taught us, nonviolence. 2 months ago, with my family, my wife and child, we went to Selma, the small town in Alabama, where in 1965, in the month of March, a few hundred people in the leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. decided to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and they were set upon by the local white Ku Klux Klan and the government there. And the rest, as I said, is history. Fast forward, we are living in a time now where the Hindu nationalists are hobnobbing with the white racists. Steve Bannon, you Google and you will find his pictures. He was a keynote speaker at one of the events organized by Hindu nationalists in America. Look up the pictures of 6th of January, insurrection at US Capitol in Washington, D.C., and you will find a man waving the Indian flag. That man has been connected with the Vishwa Hindu Parishad of America. This is a very serious threat. This ideology, like I said, is not only opposed to Muslims in India. It is not only opposed to global Muslims. It is also opposed to global peace and global progress. I am not overstating the case when I say to you that the biggest threat to multiculturalism in the West today comes from Hindu nationalism. As some of you know, I am a Hindu myself. I work for a Muslim organization. I work for the Muslim community. A lot of people often ask me, Brother Ajit, you are a Hindu. Why do you work for Muslims? And I tell them, I do not work for Muslims or Hindus or Christians or Jews. I work for justice. I work for liberty. I work for freedom. And these are fundamental values that human society has learned through centuries of struggles. That we must all of us must believe in these fundamental values and practice them. In conclusion, I would like to say to you that 100 years ago, when Savarkar, who was born today, 28th of May, when he propounded the ideology of Hindu nationalism, at the very same time, Mahatma Gandhi, who needs no introduction, was propounding his vision of the Hindu religion, which was fundamentally inclusive, peaceful, and believed in coexistence. As we all know, Gandhi was assassinated, and he was assassinated by a man who was a disciple of Savarkar. In fact, Savarkar was also accused in the criminal trial of masterminding Gandhi's assassination. Today, India is at crossroads. Being the second most populated country in the world, it is now the world which is also at crossroads. India is racing towards authoritarianism. It is racing towards despotism. It is racing towards mass genocide of Muslims and God knows who else. Because if 250 million Muslims cannot be safe in a country, then the 30 million Christians in India will not be safe. We have to fight the good fight here. We have a job right, we have a job cut out for us right here in the United States of America. Please support this good fight, all of you. I urge ICNA, Islamic Circle of North America, and all the other organizations that are represented here to accept, understand, and imbibe the fact that unless and until we come together to fight Hindutva right here in the United States and defeat it in the United States, discredit Hindutva, discredit the organizations that are peddling Hindutva, unless we do that, we will not be able to bring peace in our own society, and we will definitely see a horrible tragedy unfold in India. I would say, let us take a pledge today that we will not leave a stone unturned. We will not spare any action in reaching out to Congress, in reaching out to the executive branch, to the White House, to the National Security Council, to the U.S. Department of State. As an organization, we do that. Other organizations also do that. But we need the community to step forward. We need Muslims of all backgrounds, all ethnicities in the United States to come together and ensure that we are fighting this to the last mile as a community, as constituents in different districts, as residents of towns and cities and counties and states. We take the battle to its political, logical conclusion. Remember, Savarkar's ideology wants all Muslims out of India. If not out, Savarkar's ideology wants Muslims in India to go to prison, to lose their citizenship, and to eventually be killed. We cannot allow that. Thank you so much. Assalamu alaikum.
What you just heard was a speech on Hindutva delivered on May 28, 2022 at the ICNA Mass Convention by Ajit Sahi, Advocacy Director at the Indian American Muslim Council. You're listening to Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, Executive Producer and host of Arab Voices. The Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, the largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization in the United States, and JITPAC held a news conference on October 25, 2022 in Washington, D.C., to announce the release of the first national directory of local, state, and federal elected Muslim officials and judges in the United States. CARE and JITPAC's directory documented 189 elected officials holding local and state office across 30 states. These officials include members of Congress, state legislators, mayors, counselors, school board officials, judiciary members, and law enforcement. In a statement issued by CARE Government Affairs Director Robert McCown, he said, quote, "This report shows that American Muslims are confidently participating in American life and actively involving themselves in the political process. The year 2022 is set to be another record-setting year for American Muslims in politics, with historic victories anticipated in states across the nation." Unquote. I'm going to air now the remarks delivered at that press conference held by CARE and JITPAC announcing that first national directory.
My name is Ibrahim Hooper. I'm National Communications Director for the Council on American Islamic Relations, the nation's largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization. We're here today to outline a new report that we're releasing today, Directory of American Muslim Elected Officials. First of all, we'll hear from our CARES National Executive Director, Nihad Awad, who will offer a few words of introduction. Nihad.
Thank you, Ibrahim. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be to you. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. The Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, and JITPAC are excited to announce the release of the first ever National Directory of Local, State, and Federal Elected American Muslim Officials and Judges. Over the past year, CARE and JITPAC have confirmed 189 American officials who identify as Muslim that hold state or local offices across 30 states, with 40 Muslim elected officials in New Jersey, 39 in Michigan, and nearly 30 in state legislatures across the United States. This directory is proof that American Muslims continue to rise in American politics locally and at the state and federal level. CARE and JITPAC have been tracking and reporting on American Muslim candidates running for office since 2016. The National Directory of Elected Muslim Officials is the culmination of that work. I would also note that in 2020, CARE and JETPAC released a comprehensive report of all Muslim-identifying candidates who ran for public office in 2020, titled American Muslims Breaking Barriers Running for Office for 2020. CARE and JETPAC's report found record number of 181 Muslim candidates ran for office in 28 states and in Washington, D.C. in 2020, out of which 80 were successfully elected to office. This directory also serves as a benchmark as the 2022 directory of elected Muslim officials. Following the midterm elections in November, we will issue an updated directory in January documenting which American Muslims are actively serving in office for 2023. We know that there are even more elected Muslim officials who might not be in this directory. We look forward to updating our directory. So if you are an elected Muslim official who is not in this list, please contact CARE or JETPAC to include you in the next edition. CARE and JETPAC will continue to track and report on the political rise and empowerment of American Muslim community, inspiring and tracking candidates, reporting on elected officials, and connecting lawmakers with their communities. Thank you.
I would like to introduce Mohammed Mazuri, Executive Director of JETPAC.
So thank you, Nihad, for that presentation and for, you know, for collaboration over many years. We're really excited to announce this report for the reasons outlined by Nihad. But I also just want to add to what he was saying is that when we first started collecting this in 2016, we noticed that 23 first-time candidates ran. We believe a total of 54 in our list, people ran in total. In 2020, that number of candidates total who ran for office or on the ballot was 170 from our community. So as you can tell, the trend has been positive throughout. In the last midterm election, we had, we believe, about 63 people ran for office. Because those, in the last off-year number, the number this year we believe is going to be higher, which we're going to report on next month. The positive trends for our community is that many people are running for local office. So it's not just, you know, people running for Congress, and it's a large number of people who are winning. And the reason for why that matters is that when Muslims run for local office, they can have a massive impact on education policy, housing policy, and climate justice. Those issues are issues that impact our community all over the country. And in addition to that, the other very, you know, key reason for running for local office is that today's municipal official is tomorrow's state legislator. And, you know, today's state legislator is tomorrow's member of Congress. That's how you build a pipeline. That's how you build infrastructure that is sustainable for our community. So we're really grateful that so many people are running for local office, running for mayor, running for state legislatures. In 2020, we set a record, we had historic wins for state legislature in Oklahoma, Indiana, Colorado, Florida, Wisconsin, and Delaware. This year, we're feeling very confident that we're going to have wins in adding to our numbers in Georgia and Minnesota, as well as in Georgia and Minnesota electing the first Muslims in the state Senate, Muslim women. And then we're hoping for historic victories in Maine, Ohio, California, and Illinois as well, and Texas, for state legislature. So I'm going to stop it there and see if there are any questions. And actually, I'm going to turn it over to Robert, and then we'll take questions later. Thank you.
All right. And finally, we'll have a few concluding remarks from CARE's Government Affairs Director, Robert McCaw.
Thank you very much, Ibrahim. Assalamu alaikum. Again, my name is Robert McCaw. I'm CARE's National Government Affairs Director. I've been with CARE since 2011, right before that historic 2012 election. And I can tell you, going back all those years, the media has always been interested in how many Muslims are running for office, how many Muslims are in office, and what is the success of Muslim candidates. This directory is a culmination of several years of work to track and report the viability of Muslim candidates in American Muslim in larger races. And we are now at the point where we can not only just track candidate victories, but we are now documenting this in a directory of elected Muslim officials. This is part of the institution building of the American Muslim community as we track the political rise of American Muslims. This will become an annual report that CARE and Jetpack will collaborate on together. And we now have a benchmark of success for the American Muslim community. It's very enheartening to see that American Muslims are running for office and they have the trust of their communities to represent that broader interest. This isn't just Muslims electing Muslims. This is entire communities electing Muslims. And we're going to reflect this reality in this report. And I would invite you to read this report, get to know your elected Muslim officials, and also celebrate this, because this is not only an accomplishment for the American Muslim community, but for all Americans, as we have a more progressive and inclusive democracy that really represents the true reality of what America is. So thank you very much for reviewing this report with us, and please look forward to our next report as we track this great trend. Today, we will be publishing a press release on CARE's website, putting it on Twitter and Facebook, Instagram, linking to our report.
What you just heard were the remarks delivered at a press conference held by the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, and Jetpack in October 2022, announcing the release of the first national directory of local, state, and federal elected Muslim officials and judges in the United States. CARE and Jetpack's directory documented 189 elected officials holding local and state office across 30 states. I have a link to the full report or directory on our website, arabvoices.net. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.